This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. On March 14th, 2008, the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia met to hear Dr. Francis Collins, author, UVA alumnus, head of the Human Genome Project, and director of the National Human Genome Research Institute.
I'm happy to announce the continuation of the speaker series for this week with the illustrious Dr. Francis Collins. Obviously, we didn't have a speaker last week on account of spring break, but we'll have speakers for the rest of the semester. And I'd first like to thank the Undergraduate Research Network for all the hard work they provided. I'm helping co-sponsor and arranging the logistics for Dr. Francis Collins. I'm very excited to hear what he says, but before I begin, I'd just like to give a really quick bio so you guys know who he is. He was raised in Stanton, Virginia, and he, in 1966, enrolled at the University of Virginia, on which he received his B.S. in chemistry in 1970. He then went on to earn his Ph.D. in physical chemistry in 1974 at Yale University. It was actually, though, in a biochemistry class at Yale that he recognized the future of genetics, and then transferred to UNC at Chapel Hill to get his MD in 1977. He is renowned for his work and leadership in the Human Genome Project in the early 90s, and as a result, he was appointed to his current position as director of the National Human Genome Research Institute in D.C., I believe.
Close enough.
And in 2006, he published a book called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief, showing his experiences in both Christianity and genetics. And it's very fascinating because he mentions how he had this transformation and described science as a form of worship. Without further ado, as you can see, it's genomics, medicine, and society. And may I present Dr. Francis Collins.
Thank you, sir.
Good heavens. It wasn't weird enough speaking in a chapel. All of you standing up to applaud is blowing me away, but thank you. That's very kind. Well, I've had a wonderful time here. I got here at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. I spent some time with the second-year students in a science seminar that Professor Trindle oversees. I had a few drinks with these guys at a wonderful little reception and a wonderful restaurant that we all enjoyed. Thank you. And I've been looking forward to this, although I did not quite expect this venue. This is really interesting. I sort of feel like we should sing or pray or something, but, you know, maybe that would scare everybody, so we won't. What I want to try to do in this next little bit is to give you a sense of some of the really amazing, exciting things that are happening in the field of human genomics, the study of human DNA, and how that is going to transform, and already is, the practice of medicine, and ultimately spill out also into lots of aspects that are outside of medicine that have an effect on society. So they will affect us all. And we clearly need to be prepared for that and need to be prepared to be engaged in some of the discussions about what the appropriate uses of this technology might be in order to maximize the benefits and minimize the risks. It is wonderful to be here at UVA. As you heard, this is where I spent my undergraduate years. Yes, thank you. I came here in 1966. At that point, there were no women on campus, and let me say that was a really bad thing. And let me say, we also wore coats and ties and went to 8 a.m. classes on Saturday, and that was a really bad thing. And my senior year here, we almost burned the campus down because it was Cambodia and all of that stuff. So what a transformation occurred in those 4 years. Things seem a little more stable here now, but that's probably just because I'm visiting, and you probably all would say it's not stable at all, nor should it necessarily be. And what I'm going to talk about here this evening in terms of science and medicine and society is not stable either, but we certainly hope that it will be unstable in a good way and not in a bad way. I recognize that I suspect there's a variable familiarity with science represented here. Some of you are science geeks. A lot of you are not. So I'm going to try to be fairly jargon-free, but not so much as to bore the scientists in the audience. And I'm going to walk through some of the things that are happening in terms of the science of genomics and how that is going to change the practice of medicine And then a lot of the ethical, legal, and social issues we'll spend a fair amount of time on, because I suspect that's a particularly appropriate topic for the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society to wrestle with. And I hope to have the chance to hear your questions and your discussion as we wind this into the evening. So, no doubt you've been aware things are happening in genetics. If Time magazine says so, it must be true. By the way, the colors in these slides you're going to see, I have never seen them in quite this view before. I'm going to occasionally look shocked, and maybe you won't be able to figure out what's here. And this is a uniquely bilious representation of a Time magazine cover, but there it is. From a while ago, genetics, the future is now. Newsweek, the race to decode the human body. Genome, Time magazine again, solving the mysteries of DNA. All of these covers have two things in common, DNA and naked people. Do you think there's a reason for that? Well, I can tell you the reason. Editors know that DNA does not sell magazines. But what is this all this fuss about anyway? I gather that World News Tonight on ABC, did anybody watch the evening news? They had a big thing on genomics. I think I was on it, but I didn't get to see it. So, you know, the press is really interested in this stuff. And why are they interested? Because of the promise that this is really going to change our view of ourselves and our ability to keep ourselves healthy. So let's briefly, oh my gosh, would you look at that? So this is DNA, although it's never quite looked this way before, spilling out of the nucleus of the cell with the double helix basically revealing itself in this cartoon as this amazing information-carrying molecule written in a language that has just four letters in its alphabet, which are really chemical bases, A, C, G, and T. And all of the DNA of an organism is its genome. Fruit flies have genomes. Bacteria have genomes, and you have a genome, and yours is about 3.1 billion of those letters. That's a lot of information. If we decided here in this chapel to have a responsive reading of the human genome, and I asked this person over here to start, and then we'd pass it around until we got done, your education would be not so good, because you'd have to stay here 7 days a week, 24 hours a day for 31 years to get through that script. But we have it all done. You can go back to your computer tonight and begin to read it out, because it's all there in a public database, the DNA instruction book of human beings. Now, how does DNA cause trouble, and how does it actually serve, for the most part, to keep us actually doing pretty well? Well, DNA is the instruction book, but it doesn't carry out the instructions. That's done by transcribing DNA into RNA, which is a messenger that carries that information off in another part of the cell to make protein. Apologies, science geeks, this is really, really awfully simple, cartoonish demonstration of the basic fundamental dogma of molecular biology, but oh well. And, you know, then the protein gets made. Does the work. Now, if there is a misspelling in DNA, and by the way, if you came this evening thinking you don't have any of those, I have really bad news for you. We all are flawed at the DNA level. We all have dozens of these glitches. And those glitches can cause trouble, because that might lead to a glitch in the RNA, which in turn would lead to a glitch in the protein, and something that doesn't quite do what it's supposed to. So the Human Genome Project, founded in 1990, very controversial at the time, aimed to read out those 3 billion letters of the human DNA code and to develop a lot of other technologies to begin to try to understand how to read it. And in 1990, most of the scientific community was opposed to this, thinking that it was impossible to actually do this in a 15-year timetable, and that it would also take money away from other efforts. And perhaps most insulting of all to those of us who are excited about this, only mediocre scientists would want to work on something as boring as reading out 3 billion letters of anything. Happily, that did not come true, and some of the best and brightest scientists of the current generation got on board. And in fact, in April 2003, all of the goals of the Human Genome Project were accomplished more than 2 years ahead of schedule, and if you happen to be paying taxes, about $400 million under the budget that was originally proposed. That doesn't happen very often, does it? Thank you. I was waiting for that. So what did that represent? That meant that we had read out the 3 billion letters of the human DNA from an anonymous series of about 6 donors, people who answered a newspaper ad in the northern part of the U.S. and whose identities will be forever unknown. And that was cool. And we learned a huge amount by having this DNA sequence in front of us. So a small sampling of cool things about the genome. One was to discover just how few in number the proteins are that seem to be encoded by this gene. You know, a gene codes for a protein. Well, we had thought for the longest time that there were about 100,000 genes in the genome. And instead, there only turn out to be about 20,000, very close to the same number that a fruit fly and a roundworm have, which some people were quite offended by, but it is the data. And I must say, our genes must be pretty clever because fruit flies and roundworms have not sequenced their own genome, so there must be something special about it. Another thing we learned is that only about 1.5% of these 3 billion letters in the human genome are actually involved in coding for protein. And that was the part we sort of thought we knew something about, and that left an awful lot we don't know something about. And there's lots of other critical functions there that determine whether a gene is on or off in a particular circumstance, and a lot of biology and a lot of medicine rests in that other part. And perhaps most significantly in terms of our understanding of who we are as a species, we discover how remarkably alike we all are. 99% plus of my DNA is the same as yours, and that would be true regardless of which one of you I picked and where your ancestors came from. And that makes us different than a lot of other species that have much more DNA diversity than we do, and it tells us that we're recently descended from a common set of ancestors, probably no more than 5,000 generations, separating all of us from that common ancestral pool, which is to say we are one family. Now, what about disease? I'm a physician. The main reason to do this, oh boy, you're not going to see those pie charts very well. Well, let me tell you what they would have said. The idea here is to try to point out the ways in which genes and environment play a role in disease. For sickle cell anemia, that's a genetic condition, but certainly the kind of medical care you get will have a lot to do with how you do. So even there is some environmental contribution. For diabetes, the one in the middle, if you could have seen the pie chart, it would say genetics and environment about 50-50. For AIDS, which you might wonder, what's that doing up here? That's an infectious disease. Well, there are still host factors encoded by your DNA that have a lot to do with what happens if you happen to get exposed to this awful virus in terms of how rapidly it progresses or even if it progresses at all. So whatever disease you're interested in understanding, the study of the human genome offers a lot of promise to give you those answers. And to really go then to try to understand those answers, one needs to understand those variations in the human DNA, that less than 1% where we differ, and particularly the ones here shown as ticking time bombs that could potentially cause trouble by predisposing to illness. And frankly, until about a year and a half ago, we did not have the tools to find these for diseases like diabetes or heart disease or the common cancers very effectively. That has all changed, and it has changed extremely recently. And when you pick up the newspaper, you see a story almost every week about new discoveries and genetic factors for Crohn's disease or heart disease or asthma or high blood pressure. It is because these new tools have really begun to pay off. One reason for that being the International HapMap Project, an effort I had the privilege of leading, which basically pulled together scientists from 6 countries to really define that catalog of human variation and try to provide the tools that would enable us to figure out which variants are correlated with which disease. The first success story of this, a disease called macular degeneration, a common cause of blindness in the elderly, a disease that robbed my aunt of her vision for the last 10 years of her life. Many of you who have elderly grandparents or great aunts or great uncles will know people who have had this happen to them. And here's a disease, you know, it doesn't come on until you're 70 or 80. Can that have a genetic component? Well, it certainly does. It turns out this gene called complement factor H, if you have a particular spelling of it, it greatly increases your risk of this disease, especially if you happen to smoke. So it's a gene-environment interaction. And nobody would have guessed that this gene would have had anything to do with this disease, except we finally have the ability to scan the whole genome and find the answers. See, that's the real story of the genome revolution. The human genome is a bounded set of information. It's not going to get any bigger. There's just those 3.1 billion base pairs. We have them. We have the tools to scan across them and find those ticking time bombs for macular degeneration and a long list of other diseases. And finally, those mysteries that have haunted us for decades are revealing their secrets. This is a diagram which is going to be a little hard to appreciate, but maybe in a gestalt sort of way. In 2005, the first discovery, that's macular degeneration over there, was made possible by this new genomic approach. In 2006, we had three more discoveries. In 2007, in just the first 3 months, we had that. Another 3 months, we had that. Another 3 months, we had that. And by the end of 2007, we had that. And by this past month, February 2008, there are 100 discoveries there of genes involved in common disease that we had no clue about 2 years ago. And that makes the whole science of understanding diabetes and heart disease and cancer vastly different than it was in a very short time. And that's enormously exciting for those of us who are trying to figure out what causes those diseases anyway, how do you prevent them, and how do you treat them? So what is going to be the impact of all this on the practice of medicine? Are we really going to see this revolution, and when is it going to happen? It is going to happen. The timing is more difficult to predict because we have to travel through these various steps. So a disease with a genetic component, with the tools we have from the Genome Project and HapMap, is revealing its secrets today in terms of genetic risk factors. In some instances, knowing you're at high risk for a disease can be extremely valuable because it allows you to practice preventive medicine that's just right for you, not some one-size-fits-all recommendation, but for you. For instance, here's a family I know that has had several individuals with cancer, colon cancer, uterine cancer, colon cancer. The other people in this family are getting pretty worried about their circumstances. This kind of family can now go through genetic testing and find out who's at very high risk. Families like this generally are those in which we can find a specific mutation in one of three different genes that cause this kind of finding. And it turns out this person and this person and that person have inherited the same genetic predisposition and have a 60% chance of getting colon cancer if they don't do anything. Well, why would you want to know that? A very good reason. If you're in that situation, and you know it, and you begin colonoscopy at age 30 instead of age 50, and you do it faithfully every year instead of every 5 years, you're going to have your life saved, because you will find those small polyps before they have a chance to become invasive malignancies and get them out of there. And that's very clearly a demonstrated success story in predictive preventive medicine based on genetic testing. This is going to begin to appear in other places as well. The list of conditions for which we now have really strong data that this is life-saving is still short, but it's growing. Of course, you will notice that family only came to attention because of the family history. Here's something you could do yourself now if you're interested in trying to take advantage of genetics for your own health. Take advantage of a genetic test that is free. It's called your family history. It's a pretty good predictor. Can tell you what your own risks might be. Working with the United States Surgeon General, and you can read about it at this website, we put together an opportunity for people to collect their own family medical history in a standardized form because busy physicians rarely get around to doing this. You can do it yourself. You can get a standard medical pedigree. You can take it to your doc and say, let's talk about this. What about these uncles who had heart disease? What should I be doing about that? And start a conversation about better prevention. Okay, what else? Pharmacogenomics, what the heck is that? Well, here's an opportunity to use genetics in a somewhat different way, which is to try to figure out how to pick the right drug for the right person. As a physician, I can tell you that if I have 100 people with a particular condition for which there is a standard drug therapy, and I give that therapy to those 100 people, they're not all going to have a good benefit from it. Some of them will do pretty well. Some of them don't seem to have much response. Some of them may even have a toxic side effect. What's that all about? Well, a lot of that is because of genetics. Take all these people with the same diagnosis, you get different outcomes. And that may very well be because of different genetic variants in that group of people that are actually pretty good predictors of what's going to happen. And as we increasingly learn about that for more and more drugs, we can begin to tailor the way in which prescriptions are written so that there's a better chance of a good outcome. That's what pharmacogenomics is doing for us. Don't be surprised if in the next 4 or 5 years, you go to your doctor with an illness that needs a prescription, and the doc says, before we do this, let's check your DNA. and be sure this is the right drug at the right dose for you. But I actually think the biggest payoff in the long term is going to be down here, where we take this information about genes and we use them because they shine a bright light on the real cause of disease to develop much better treatments. Treatments that are not treating some secondary problem, but going right to the heart of the matter. And some of those will be gene therapies, although that's been a pretty difficult road. And a lot of them will be drug therapies based on an understanding at the gene level of what it is that you're trying to do. The most dramatic current example of this is a drug called Gleevec. This is developed to treat a particular type of leukemia called chronic myeloid leukemia that's been studied for quite a long time. Leukemia arises in a single blood cell somewhere in the bone marrow that acquires a mutation. That mutation results in the production of a protein that is a bad actor. And it has this active site right here, which binds a molecule called ATP. And if it binds ATP, bad things happen. It transforms normally well-behaved white cells into malignant white cells, which is what leukemia is. Well, think about it. If you could come up with a compound, an organic chemical compound, that actually bound into that site and blocked it so that ATP couldn't get in there, that might be useful. That was Brian Druker's idea at Oregon, and he linked up with Novartis, a pharmaceutical company, and they came up with a compound that did exactly that, in a lock-and-key fashion, got in the way of that active site. 32 patients signed up for the first trial of this drug. They were patients with far advanced leukemia who had failed all other means of therapy and were not expected to live more than 3 or 4 weeks. 32 patients, 7 years ago. 31 of them are at work today. This was a dramatic result in terms of a specific targeted therapy that you can take by mouth that has very little in the way of side effects because it goes specifically to block this bad protein, which we normally don't have at all. And so, therefore, the impact on normal systems is quite limited. That's the kind of designer drug that we hope to see developed now for hundreds of diseases as we understand them as well as we now understand leukemia. So you can expect, as a result of all that, this development of diagnostics and pharmacogenomics and therapeutics for different diseases at different paces. Cancer will come quicker than others. Over the course of the next 15 or 20 years, this will revolutionize the practice of medicine. And that's a good thing, because right now medicine, in many ways, is still more of an art than a science. Sometimes it's not even an art. We need to do better. But okay, you might say, let's talk about all the other implications of this set of advances. Where are we going with this? Reading out our own instruction book, if it cures cancer, sounds like a good thing. If it's designer babies, maybe I want to think about that. So what about the ethical, legal, and social implications of all of this? Well, one of the things that I am most proud of with the Human Genome Project is that from the very beginning, a significant fraction of the resources in the budget were put into addressing these ethical, legal, and social issues. And out of that has come a cohort of hundreds of investigators from law, from social science, from bioethics, from theology, that are helping us think through what are the consequences outside of medicine that we ought to be prepared for. We haven't done that before. In the past, science has kind of gone on, and suddenly people have woken up one day and go, oh, why didn't we think of that? This time we're trying to think of it ahead of time. And I think we're making some reasonable progress, but it's still an experiment in progress. So I want to point out to you a few of the issues that this ethical, legal, and social implication program has identified as high priority and tell you where we stand. And I suspect you'll have others to point to in the discussion. This is, to my mind, perhaps the most pressing. It is the one that was identified almost from the beginning. If we are, in fact, in a circumstance of being able to offer individuals like that family with colon cancer the chance to find out their own predisposition to illness, is that going to get used against you? If you were in that family and you got tested and you were positive and you needed a colonoscopy every year beginning at age 30, but your health insurance company said, we've just discontinued your policy, you have been harmed. And that is a violation of principles of equity and justice. And yet, at the present time, we do not have adequate protections against that outcome. Many states have tried to take action here and, in fact, have done a reasonable job of it, but it's a patchwork across the country. The only effective solution has to be federal legislation. So why don't we have it? Well, goodness knows we've been trying. By the way, that is a descriptor of what you will all be on the receiving end of if we don't solve this problem of genetic discrimination. Because remember, we are all flawed. This is not about somebody else. This could be about you. In the 108th Congress, which if you're keeping track was 5 years ago, this bill, S-1053, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2003, or GINA, was brought to the floor of the Senate, and it passed unanimously. And I sat in the gallery that day and thought, all right, this is finally happening, especially because the administration supports this bill. The House of Representatives, under pressure from some special interests, did not act upon the bill, and it died in the 108th. In the 109th Congress, again came up for a Senate vote and passed unanimously again. This time the House gave it a number, but held no hearings, and it died in the 109th. We're now in the 110th Congress. I'm happy to say we have numbers in both houses. And this time, the House of Representatives took major interest in this bill, brought it to a vote on April 25th of last year, and it passed 420-3. That's a pretty close vote, huh, for a chamber that said they didn't think this should be voted on the year before. Well, what do you know? I figured that had to be it, right? The Senate's already passed this bill twice. The administration supports it. We're done here. And we're not done here. The way things work in Washington, once something really starts to happen, then the opposition really gets in gear. And here's a bill that would prevent genetic discrimination in health insurance and in the workplace. And while the health insurance industry has gotten comfortable with this, because they really don't want to use this for underwriting as long as no other company does either, the employment community, on the other hand, at least as represented by the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, decided that they didn't like the precedent here of employers being told what they can do and what they can't do. And so with a great deal of lobbying muscle, this bill, S-358, has remained on hold as the action of a single senator from a state that begins with O has kept this from moving now for the space of some 9 months. And it is not clear whether it is going to get moving, despite the fact that if it came for a vote on the floor of the Senate today, this would pass, if not unanimously, extremely close to that. Does that make sense to you? It doesn't make sense to me. But our political system is wired basically to deal with crisis. It is not well wired to deal with preventive legislation. And most people have not yet had a genetic test and therefore have not yet experienced genetic discrimination. And our system seems to be saying, let's wait until we have victims, lots of them, and then maybe action will occur. That's not a good system, if you ask me. Let us hope that the year 2008 is the one where this finally is found to be acceptable in the Senate and passes and is signed into law. Because the accelerated pace of genetic discovery is not slowing down. Already, the absence of this legislation is causing us terrific difficulties trying to do research, because people who are offered genetic tests as part of research protocols ask about this, and when they hear there's not adequate protection, they often say no thanks. Interesting, isn't it? This mix between science, research on ethical issues, and actual policy decisions. Not an easy handoff. Well, here's another one that's a little tricky. Are all these genetic tests that are popping out all over the place being subjected to adequate oversight? What would adequate oversight look like? Or should we just let the marketplace determine what people are willing to pay for? Well, that's a good question, and there's not an easy answer. At the moment, in the last several months, three companies, Decode Genetics, Navigenetics, and 23andMe, have announced, and two of these have already started marketing, direct-to-consumer DNA testing. What do you do here? You spit in a tube, because that's got DNA in it. You ship it off to their place in California or Iceland, and they send you, a few weeks later, a passcode. You go to their website, punch in your passcode, and it tells you what did they find in your DNA. And that includes information about ancestry, which is probably being predicted more precisely than the data would allow, but it's probably of some interest. And it also includes medical information about your risks for diabetes and heart disease and cancer and asthma and a long list of other conditions. Write it down to some truly silly things like whether your earwax is wet or not. I think a Q-tip is a pretty good way to tell that, but You can also use DNA, apparently. So is this okay? Well, in a certain way, it's okay because, you know, an interested person who wants the information, should we get in their way? But this is complicated stuff. If you were given that list of risk factors, all in statistical terms, these are not yes-no answers. These are, your risk is 40% greater for this one and 20% less for that one. Well, what does that mean? What should you do about it? Is there something you can do about it? How do these sort of renditions of your particular DNA empower you as opposed to frightening you? None of that work's been done yet. And so here we are in a circumstance where the advances in genetics have very quickly found their way into the marketplace before we've had time to really know whether that's going to be empowering or not. And at the moment, there is no oversight of this at all. People can market to you genetic tests that are utterly bogus. These companies are not marketing bogus tests. These are tests that actually are scientifically valid, but we don't know what to do with them. But there are companies out there that will offer you genetic testing to tell you whether you have some nutritional deficiency based upon really fanciful science. And if you do, and apparently from what I hear, most people do, then they will sell you nutrigenomic supplementations that will cost you another $1,000. And people are buying this stuff. We run a great risk here, don't we? That this wonderful science that has the potential to really revolutionize our understanding of ourselves and of medicine is going to so turn the public off because it's turned into snake oil that people will not really realize when we get to the right point of using this that it has value. A concern. What about patenting and intellectual property? Now, here has been a hot topic from the beginning of the Genome Project. Should you be able to patent a human gene? Should you be able to say, I own that one, and if anybody wants to use it, they've got to pay me? We all have these genes in our body. Does that sound right to you? Well, the argument is it's okay because those human genes in the laboratory have been stitched together in a way that does not occur in nature, propagated in some bacterial system, sequenced in a way that was necessary by a laboratory procedure, and so therefore it is appropriate to offer somebody a patent who has determined the DNA sequence, the A, C's, G's, and T's of a gene that wasn't previously known about. And a very large number of such patents have been issued. Probably 30% of the human genes have patents on them. Is this a good thing? Well, what are patents for? This is the Jefferson Society. It wasn't Jefferson who came up with patenting, it was Franklin. And the goal here really was to try to provide public benefit. I mean, doesn't that make sense? It was not to make inventors rich, although they sometimes do get rich as a result. The idea was to provide public benefit. And here's the argument. The idea is if you made a discovery, if you invented something, but it hadn't yet sort of been reduced to practice, it hadn't been turned into a product that the public could actually use, then you need a sort of limited monopoly, a protected time, to develop your invention into that product and to be able to sell it without having a competitor who's done nothing come in and take your market away. That's the argument about why patents are good for the public, and it's a pretty good argument. But if you've sequenced a gene and you don't even know what it does, and you have no plans to do anything with it, you just want to claim it, is that in fact what Franklin had in mind? Don't think so. But that's a lot of what has happened. And you can see what happens as a result. Patents become then not an incentive for research, they become a disincentive, because who wants to work on a gene that's already owned? And so if somebody does discover something about that gene that might be useful as a diagnostic or a therapeutic, they're going to go, eh, why bother? That other guy already owns it. We've made a big mess for ourselves here. And we have this complicated thicket now of intellectual property claims on things that should have been placed in the public domain that are going to vex us until these patents ultimately run out. I'm proud to say the Human Genome Project from the very beginning saw this risk and made a radical decision, as documented in this particular photograph of a whiteboard upon which this decision was written in 1996. And that is that all of us got together and said, this is about public benefit. We're discovering information that is fundamental, and we don't know what most of it means, and it ought to be in the public domain. And so we decided that every 24 hours, the data that came out of the sequencing instruments for the Human Genome Project would be placed in a public database where anybody could see it. It would be public domain. There would be no intellectual property, no subscription fees, no boundaries to access. And I think in the long term, that has been one of the most important contributions of the Genome Project, was that change in mindset about what to do with the data. And in fact, we are now using that same approach for many other aspects of what's followed on the heels of the Genome Project to try to make sure that data is immediately accessible as well without any intellectual property restrictions. What about this one? We are studying that small percentage of the human genome that differs between individuals because it has great promise to teach us about medical risks, to try to explain family histories of conditions. But that study of variation also could be potentially misused by people who want to make a case that one group is different than another, or even worse, that one group is superior to another, and we have a very long history in our species of doing so in ways that are utterly unscientific, and that's not to say that we couldn't slip into that again. These kids that you see here, or almost see here, all come from very different backgrounds. Again, their DNA is 99.9% the same. If you look at that individual differences along the chromosome and try to match them up, they have obvious differences in things like skin color. We actually have uncovered many of those. Those are good examples of how selection has benefited people living in different parts of the world by allowing them to survive in those circumstances. If you have light skin and you live at the equator, your likelihood of getting skin cancer, a horrible skin cancer, I know because I've volunteered in mission hospitals in West Africa and seen albinos, the consequence of that is a very severe outcome. If you live in Finland and you have very dark skin, and it's before the time that vitamin D is being put in the milk, you're going to get rickets, and rickets is not compatible with normal childbirth. And so skin color changes are clear examples of how in fairly recent time, over the last 50,000 years, selection has operated upon the human species. Evolution did not end 100,000 years ago. And in fact, there's indications of many other instances of this sort, most of them driven by infectious diseases that have left their imprint on our genome, depending on where your ancestors came from. And that is, again, a good indication of the survival abilities of the human species when faced with various challenges. But of course, people who are inclined to be deterministic about the genome and to make great leaps from changes that may prevent infectious diseases from spreading in a group to other attributes of humanity have, in fact, in some instances, tried to claim that this same process may apply to other human traits. And that, I think, is a concern. I should say, just 6 months ago, the person who preceded me in the job of director of the Human Genome Project, Jim Watson, made an offhand comment in a reporter's story in the London Times that, in his view, it was likely that selection had also operated on intelligence, and his group, namely Europeans, had gotten the better end of that compared to those who are in Africa. A completely unsupportable statement for which no data exists, and yet reported widely in the press, we are still, I think, trying to explain away Dr. Watson's misunderstanding of the facts when he should have known much better. You can see, therefore, that genetics can be a wonderful positive contributor to this social discourse by pointing out our similarities and the lack of real boundaries between any groups, but it can also be misused, even by those who are seen as icons of the field, if they, in fact, have a personal prejudice that spills out in this way. What about the limitations? Are we comfortable applying genetics not only to the cure of terrible diseases, but to the development of creatures that are better than they would have otherwise been, the enhancement scenario? I think that starts to make a lot of people uncomfortable, the designer babies. But let's be clear about this. This is not a simple issue. Many of you in the audience are biologically enhanced. If you had good parents, you should be, because you were vaccinated. Vaccination changes your DNA. It causes certain immune cells in your body to rearrange their DNA in order to be able to be prepared to fight off a particular infection, and that's a good thing. So for us to say disease treatment is bad, disease treatment is good, enhancement is bad, is a bright line that we don't really have the luxury of anymore. Did you take music lessons? You got enhanced. Did you come to UVA? I hope you're being enhanced. You should be. That's what the university is all about, is enhancement, darn it. So one can't be quite so clear in the language about what we're talking about here. But I think what most people are uneasy about is the idea of using this kind of genetic manipulation in a way that is depicted in this particular film, Gattaca, in a thought-provoking, albeit very Hollywood-style fashion. A society that basically decided to give up all its civil rights to worship at the altar of DNA, where all of the children get enhanced. Well, not exactly enhanced. They basically have their embryos selected as being the best of all possible embryos that that couple could have produced. And then there's a great deal of discrimination attached to those who were not benefited by that. And, of course, the hero of the story is one of the naturals, but he takes on an assumed sort of personage and hides the fact that he wasn't enhanced. And the story pretty much declares the bankruptcy of the theory in that our hero, the natural, is able to do almost everything, and all the enhanced people are smoking, drinking, and killing each other, which is probably the right answer, actually. Because most of the things that people would talk about wanting to enhance in their offspring are things like intelligence, musical ability, athletic ability, which are profoundly complicated at the DNA level, and for which environment is really important. Really, really important. So imagine a yuppie couple who decides, it's our turn, we're going to take advantage of every kind of genetic information to try to end up with the perfect child who grows up to be, you know, first chair in the college orchestra and plays quarterback on the football team and gets, you know, a 4.0. And they might be very disappointed because their kid turns out to be a goth who's smoking pot and listening to heavy metal music at maximum decibels and losing his hearing because they forgot parenting. That could happen. This is all about gene-environment interaction, and the gene contribution to things that people talk about enhancing are actually fairly minor. Okay, so maybe some of those scenarios aren't too scary. This one, more of a philosophical one, and we're getting near the end. You'll maybe be glad to know, and we're going to then see what you're thinking about, you want to talk about. This is more of a philosophical question. With all this excitement about DNA, and I'm pretty excited about DNA, and I hope you are too, are we getting carried away? Are we losing our perspective? Are we beginning to think of ourselves somehow as these marionettes controlled by invisible wires that are made of double helices, and free will is kind of looking a little bit less impressive, and everything about us begins to feel like it's all driven by heredity? And it's just a matter of time until we admit that. Well, you know what? That is not a proper interpretation of the science of genetics. Many of the things that we are interested in studying when it comes to human traits are partly genetic and very strongly not genetic. And free will is not going to go out the window just because we get smart about DNA. But there's a real risk here. If we go too far down that pathway, it will be tempting to forget the environment. And we cannot afford to forget the environment, especially as our planet is in great risk right now. And it's also tempting in that deterministic perspective to begin to undervalue what the human spirit is all about and our need for a spiritual component of our lives, and to begin to think of ourselves in much more materialistic forms. And you can already hear that echoing from some of the loud spokespersons from the atheistic branch of the scientific community, people like Harris and Dawkins. And I think that would be a true tragedy if somehow this discovery of the amazing, awesome nature of human life were to lead us to downgrade our impression of God's creative ability as opposed to upgrade it. Look at those two images, if you can. They're in a different color than I've ever seen them. This is the rose window at Yorkminster Cathedral. This is an unfamiliar view of DNA. Not looking at it from the side, but looking down the barrel of the double helix, revealing its radial pattern. Interesting comparison. Do we have to choose one or the other? As somebody who is both a scientist and a believer who arrived at his faith in his 20s, I would say it would be a great tragedy if somehow, in the future, one of these had to survive and the other had to die, because that's not the kind of future I want to live in. And I would also say, and I've written about this in a book called The Language of God, that the current battle that seems to be raging between fundamentalist believers on the one hand and fundamentalist atheists on the other, and they are both fundamentalists, is a wholly unnecessary one. And it's time to basically take the microphone away from the extremists and talk a little bit more about the way to find harmony between these worldviews, a harmony that is not difficult at all to find once you step away from those extreme perspectives. Let me conclude with then a bit of a glimpse of where the future might go, and then we'll have some discussion. Imagine that it is 2015. Let's talk about Betty. Betty is, at that point, 25 years old. She completes the Surgeon General's family history tool that I told you about, and she learns that she has uncles with early heart disease that she was never quite sure about. She goes to her healthcare provider. He's, unlike many healthcare providers, actually stayed up and stayed informed with genomic medicine and suggests, well, why don't you just have your genome sequenced? I kid you not, in 2015, that's extremely likely to be possible for $1,000 or less. Not just checking a few places, the whole thing for $1,000. That's the trajectory we're on. Well, Betty's a little worried about who's going to know about this and what are they going to do. Happily, in 2008, effective legislation has outlawed this. The sequence is analyzed. She's found to have three gene variants that have been shown conclusively in well-validated studies to increase her risk of her early heart attack by about a factor of four. So, given that information, she's interested in prevention. She and her provider sit down, design a program of prevention based on diet, exercise, and medication that is just right for her. It's not some one-size-fits-all approach. This is Betty's preventive strategy. She participates in community activities, a good thing. Comes to evening sessions of the Jefferson Society, learns all about this. These guys are so easy. She does well until age 75, but then she gets some left arm pain that she thinks is maybe due to gardening, but her provider, knowing her higher risk, diagnoses a heart attack, an acute myocardial infarction. Her sequence being available, the provider knows what drugs to choose that will work best to treat her. She survives and is live and well in the 22nd century. Hooray. That's what we want to see happen for all of us who imagine ourselves in that same boat. Some of us a little too old, perhaps, but not you all. But could we count on that? Or do we have work to do to make that dream come true? Suppose, in an alternative universe, Betty's story has gone wrong. Betty never learns about her family history. Educational efforts that would have provided that information were defunded, and community efforts never got off the ground. And Betty's provider thought genetics was about rare diseases you see up there at the University of Virginia Hospital, and it's irrelevant to the practice of that provider. Betty heard about genome sequencing, but after seeing her brother lose his health insurance because the stupid Congress for many years failed to take care of this, she decided she would better leave that out. So, without any advance information or any prevention recommendations, she eats an unhealthy diet, gains some weight, and develops high blood pressure. Now, maybe a test might have been available by then to help her choose the right drug, but that work wasn't done either. The National Institutes of Health budget kept getting cut, and so there was no information there. Betty was treated with a drug that causes a hypersensitivity reaction, a really bad thing, and so she stops treatment. After 10 years of uncontrolled high blood pressure and obesity, Betty develops left arm pain, not at age 75, at age 50. Here comes the heart attack. Unaware of her high risk, her provider says, oh, women don't get heart attacks at age 50. Assumes it's some sort of muscle strain and prescribes rest. Rest. Yeah, it's not the right answer for Betty. She returns to the emergency room a few hours later in cardiogenic shock. The absence of any information about her genome prevents immediate choice of therapy. The wrong drugs are chosen. Betty dies in the ER. A very bad story indeed. So my challenge to me and to all of you and to the rest of the world is two words. Save Betty, because in many ways, Betty is all of us. And you could see how this scenario could play out in very different ways, depending on how committed we all are, to take advantage of this remarkable historical moment that we are in the midst of, to bring it forward for benefits of enormous sorts in terms of medicine, and in terms of public policy and education and all the other things that have to be attached to this for this to be the kind of positive outcome that we dream of. So, the dream needs you, needs all of us. I think it's fair to say that here in 2008, we are at an inflection point. We have arrived at a point where we understand our own instruction book at a level of detail not imagined even 20 years ago maybe not even 5 years ago. And we are about to see that move into the practice of medicine, into societal consequences at a pace that most people are unaware of. I believe, because I'm an optimist, that this is a really remarkable moment and that we should all celebrate that. But the part of me that's a bit of a worrier also says we've got a lot of work to do to make that dream come true. And so what a better place than the Jefferson Society to talk about this kind of an issue and its positive and potentially negative effects on our future, because here at the University of Virginia, I know there are leaders that will help us find our way from where we are into the promised land. Thank you all very much.
Short question and answer period, okay with you?
Absolutely. Thank you. There is one.
Dr. Collins, thank you very much for coming and had a really wonderful dinner with you. The question is, I'm very intrigued by the idea of trait enhancement.
Any particular traits you're interested in personally?
I would improve my intelligence a little bit better.
I thought it was pretty impressive at dinner. You could scare me that way, but go ahead. So a very appropriate question, although I'm not sure that it's as much of an immediate concern for trait enhancement as it is for medical benefits. The question, because I can see people in the back are asking for help here, was, okay, so trait enhancement is going to cost money. Isn't that going to mean that it's going to be distributed inequitably? And it might just increase the distance between the haves and the have-nots and make for worse societal unrest. Again, when it comes to trait enhancement, many of the things that people talk about are not scientifically very realistic. And in terms of intelligence, I don't think we're anywhere near to the threshold of knowing how to do that, nor am I sure we will be for a very long time. But I know we are going to be pretty close to the opportunity to offer medical benefits from all these discoveries. Many of them are going to be preventive. Betty, you saw there with the opportunity to practice preventive medicine. You know, Betty must have had some money unless our healthcare system changed, because her healthcare system would not have reimbursed her for that preventive medicine effort. Did you know that? I'm sure you've got a wind of this. Our healthcare system is so upside down that it will treat you if you're in the ICU blowing $10,000 a day on a preventable disease, but it won't spend 10 bucks to try to prevent the disease in the first place. You've got to pay that out of your pocket. That's what Medicare does, that's what Medicaid does, and all the third-party payers follow suit. So if we are serious, the genomics is going to empower this new kind of personalized, preventive, preemptive, participatory, the four P's in case you're keeping score, medicine, and it's only going to be available to people who can pay for it, we've done a terrible thing. If there is one need our country has in the area of medicine in this next few years, it is to admit that our healthcare system is not only ineffective, it's discriminatory, it's inequitable, it's unjust. And it's costing us a fortune for crappy medical care. And unless we are willing to admit that, yes, snap, unless we're willing to admit that, and unless we have leaders who are willing to pay a political price for saying so, then we're doomed to get more of the same. And more of the same is not what we need. We are the only country with this kind of resources that thinks of health care as a privilege. 46 million people in this country lack health insurance, and we're willing to turn our heads and look the other way. It's scandalous. And what you're talking about is going to make it more scandalous, because the ability of people to take advantage of new technologies at the moment depends on what your income is. And if you have any sense of what's right and just in the world, that can't be correct. Yes?
Since medicine is a very slow rate of adoption of new technology. Medicine.
Yep.
So, how do you see, overcoming this challenge of the culture of medicine adopting these strategies?
Another great question. So the question is, you may be optimistic, but what's the chance that medicine is actually going to adopt these strategies, even if they're proven to be beneficial? Isn't there a very, very long lead time before those get embraced and moved into the standard of care? I'm afraid you're absolutely right. The average time between when you have a medical intervention that has been demonstrated in controlled trials to be beneficial to patients and having it actually implemented is 17 years. There's no reason for that 17 years other than our system just basically being slow, and I'm a physician, I have to say, physicians being pretty slow to adopt something because you kind of figure, I know how to take care of patients, don't tell me what to do. This is a serious issue, and we've got to get past that if we have any real hope in any of these areas of massive advances in medicine, of having them reach the public. And again, although I hate to say it, because in another way, it turns medicine into something that is a lot less than what one would hope in terms of the art of medicine, unless we come up with a system where basically physicians and other healthcare providers are reimbursed for performance, as measured by do they in fact follow evidence-based recommendations for the care of particular conditions. I don't know how we're going to shrink that 17 years. And I wish it did not have to be so, but I think that's the reality of where we're at. And if we don't do that, science is going to accelerate. That 17 years is going to seem longer and longer because the advances are going to come faster and faster. We have to solve this. It's another big issue for us. In the back, yes. We should, of course. So your point is exactly well taken. We only have 20,000 genes, but we probably have at least 1 million proteins. The combinatorial possibilities that happen here, because genes are broken up by introns, and they have to be put back together again by splicing, and that can happen for some genes, most genes, in fact, in multiple ways. So you end up with multiple RNAs, which make multiple proteins, which then get modified by things like adding a sulfate here and a phosphate there and a sugar over here that basically make them perform in different ways. And if we really want to understand biology, we have to understand those 1 million proteins. And we would like to get there. The problem, and this is a really important one, I hope some of you will come help solve it, is that proteins are not as well behaved in the systems that we have for sort of analytical chemistry as DNA and RNA. DNA and RNA are these wonderful molecules that basically are practically designed for laboratory investigation. But proteins, every one of them is a little different in terms of its shape and its solubility and its concentration. And proteomics is orders of magnitude more difficult than is looking at DNA and RNA, studying the genome or the transcriptome. And until we do better in terms of developing methods that can scan across 6 or 7 orders of magnitude in abundance, it's going to be so much more straightforward to look at the genome than it is at the proteome. But we need to solve that. And a lot of work's being done now, sort of starting with simpler systems like bacteria, microbiology, which is, I think, he's a microbiologist, I'm just really pandering to him here, you see, that's making real progress there. But to do this for the human, we don't know how. I hope we'll know how in another 5 years. Right now, we don't know how. Right here. Hi. Sure.
For example, 2 children who had a very rare type of cancer were treated with a trial gene therapy, and then what happened was the result was leukemia instead of the original disease that they had, mm-hmm. and they ended up dying. So it seems as if that's evidence for that concern that most believers have with cancer.
It's a good question. So the question is, believers oftentimes express concerns that this kind of tampering represents an invasion into territory that belongs to God and not to humans. And an example cited, I think actually the 2 kids had a rare form of immune deficiency, X-linked SCID, who were treated with gene therapy. Many kids with that condition die in the first few months of life. It was initially a great success in that these kids seemed to have been cured of their immune deficiency. Of the 20 kids who were treated so far, two of them, though, have died of leukemia, which was clearly caused by the therapy. A great disappointment and a cause of great concern in terms of the future of gene therapy for this condition. Well, I guess the question is, what are we called to do? I'm a believer. When I look at the limited time that Christ spent on the earth that we know about, it is interesting when you read through those descriptions how much of that time was spent on trying to reach out to people who had illness to try to heal them, and in many cases, to heal them. And I think we were supposed to notice that. And I think if you look at the principles of most of the world's great religions, they agree on this, that one of our mandates as human beings is to try to alleviate suffering if we can. And that's what the whole principle of medicine, of course. I don't see genomics as actually drastically different in that regard. I do see that the ability to try to treat diseases with new therapies that are untested can sometimes go terribly wrong. And that's been true for all of human history. When people have tried to come up with a way to treat a disease, sometimes it's been completely the wrong thing, and people have died, not just from gene therapy, but from many drug trials in the past and probably in the future. And of course, that is a terrible tragedy and something that we all feel sick at heart when we see. But if we didn't try, then people with cancer and heart disease and other conditions would basically be doomed to what we can offer them now. And so what we do is we ask people to take a chance. And we ask them, are you interested in being part of a trial of an untreated, unproven therapy? And we try to tell them very explicitly what we think the risks are and what the benefits are. And then we give them the chance to decide if they want to participate or not. That is our informed consent process. That is the human subject's procedure that we follow here ever since the Nuremberg trials, which is pretty well worked out and I think generally agreed on by bioethicists. But it does sometimes go terribly wrong. Now, I think the real point, though, of your question is there's something different about manipulating genes. Is that more getting into territory that we should not be into compared to trying out a new drug? I think actually gene therapy, if you're not altering the DNA that's going to be passed to the next generation, but you're just trying to provide a functioning gene to the bone marrow of somebody with a immune deficiency or to the airway of somebody with cystic fibrosis, that doesn't seem to be a quantum difference than a drug therapy approach. Basically, the gene is the drug. You're not changing the rest of that person. You're not changing who they are. You're not changing their children. But as soon as you cross that line and say, I'm going to make a change in this person that they will pass on, or I'm going to make a change in this embryo that will lead to a person, and who knows what might happen to them or their children, then I think you've really crossed into a very scary and I think fairly indefensible territory. So I'm talking about germline gene therapy, where you change permanently the DNA of an individual in a way that affects all the cells of their body and their future offspring. That is a very difficult case to make in ethical terms. Even if you're not worried about it in terms of philosophy or theology, you should be worried about it in terms of safety because you don't know what the consequences are going to be. So I agree with you. There are real serious limits there. Yes?
I think earlier you alluded to some of the problems with private sector genomics, namely patenting and sort of like financial incentives that are there. And you've also alluded to some problems with public sector genomics with, you know, getting budget cuts at the NIH and stuff.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you can talk about maybe the difference between private sector and public sector genomics and what you're doing with the public sector.
Sure. So the question is, how do the private and the public sector investments in genomics differ? How should they work in an ideal world? There was this thing called the race for the human genome. It got a little silly in the latter part of the 1990s. There was this public project that I had the privilege of leading, consisting of some of the best and brightest scientists you'll ever meet at MIT, Washington University, Baylor, University of Washington, friends in England, in Japan, in China, in France, in Germany, all working together to try to get this done in a selfless way, giving the data away every 24 hours. There was a private effort, which was, because it was private and because stockholders were paying for it, not giving the data away. They could certainly not justify that. of course, taking in all the public data every day because it was there, there's no reason they shouldn't, and supposedly racing to the finish line, even though if we had A and they had A plus B, it was pretty clear that A plus B was going to be a little bigger at some point. Was this a good situation? Well, it got kind of silly because it was portrayed as, you know, a race to the finish line. I got very tired about reading about my motorcycle and Craig Venter's yacht because the press seemed a lot more interested in that than in the science. But why are we doing this anyway? And what's the difference between open access model and a subscription database that only people with lots of resources would be able to look at? Is it a good thing or a bad thing for the human genome to be a private commodity, or ought it to be in the public domain? Those discussions didn't happen so much. And you know, it all turned out fine. It turned out fine because it is in the public domain. That particular business model of basically spending a lot of stockholders' money to generate very fundamental information and then charge a subscription fee, that model has gone away. You won't see it anymore. There were other companies attempting to do that. It just turned out not to be a stable model. That data wanted to be public. It really was not a situation where that kind of information could survive for long behind a curtain. It was the fundamental thing that every scientist wanted to see. So I think that was a learning experience. I think we're in a much better place now. And I can tell you that I spent a great deal of my time working with private sector trying to figure out ways to be complementary and not get in each other's way, but to actually encourage each other. One of these projects to try to discover genes involved in common disease is a partnership with Pfizer, where they basically put up $25 million of Pfizer money to support work that we did as long as the data went into the public domain, because that's what they wanted too. They realized this is pre-competitive information, this is fundamental. We don't care if our competitors see it, as long as we can. The value here, the intellectual property, is downstream. It's not at this early stage. That is such a more sane perspective. Now, my institute, the Genome Institute, has a budget every year of $480 million, a lot of money, although I wish it was more because we could spend it wisely. About 20% of that actually goes in grants to the private sector, to biotechnology companies, to instrument companies that are developing new ideas about how to do DNA sequencing or proteomics or all these other things that we need. And it's very well spent money indeed. So I think we have arrived after an awkward decade at a place where, in fact, we've come back to a more sensible merging of the goals of the public and the private efforts. And that's actually quite a relief. Yes, sir.
But only temporarily, as you clearly pointed out, when saving Betty, that saving Betty might be adversely affected if NIH doesn't get enough money. And you beautifully portray how difficult it is in the political arena to, in fact, know whether money is coming.
Mm-hmm.
That being the case, why not harness vigorously the billions of dollars that are available from the private sector? I have the feeling that your position, and by the way, I read your book and I love every page.
Thank you. Thank you.
The private sector has always been willing, for the purpose of making money, to go into areas that would save Betty. And I am very unhappy at the prospect of political entities controlling the influx of care for the research. The private sector pours it in. Further, the deponent saith not.
Thank you, thank you. That was very well stated. So I agree there is more potential there than we are currently tapping into. And there are at the moment really incredibly rigorous conflict of interest circumstances that prevent me from being able, in many instances, to interact with the private sector as freely as I would like, and that is kind of getting in the way. Although we all understand why that must be. You don't really want to see these things mixed in a clumsy way or the one that implies that people are on the take. The private sector is a mixed bag. There are certainly some pharmaceutical companies, like I mentioned this example of Pfizer, that are very forward-looking and willing to consider these partnerships and to write checks. There are others that are very hunkered down and tell you, just don't bother us right now, we're trying to survive. And the big problem really is that the pipeline for drug development is running on fumes. There have not been a lot of really exciting new developments in the pharmaceutical industry in quite a long time. There's a lot of Me Too stuff. And one of the exciting things about what I told you this evening is all these discoveries, those 100 flags on that diagram of new factors involved in common disease, every one of those could be a new drug target. And this is something the pharmaceutical industry is jazzed about, and this is what's going to help Betty if they will jump on board and take full advantage of these new opportunities. Then what has been a pretty dreary kind of decade for drug development could suddenly get very exciting. I hope that will happen. Yes, over here. He's concerned about a society that strives to evade death. And I know what you mean. There's a great deal of interest out there in continuing to extend the lifespan, perhaps giving us all immortality. The books are written about that make it sound as if that might be within reach. I don't think it is within reach. I think for all of us in this room, the death rate will be one per person. And I don't know how it'll happen or when it'll happen, but one per person. So be prepared for that. But there is a great deal of interest in aging. I think to the extent that what we're trying to do is to preserve normal functioning as opposed to chronic disability, that's a very good thing. And there are people out there who think that we might be able to expand the maximum lifespan from 100 years or so to longer than that. I don't know that they actually have evidence to support that enthusiasm, although we've done that for some model organisms like roundworms, where people are able, by genetic manipulation, to allow worms to live substantially longer than they normally can, and maybe there's some implications there. My lab actually works on a rare condition called progeria. This is the most dramatic form of premature aging. These kids who are normal at birth age at about 7 times the normal rate, usually don't live more than about age 12 or 13. They die of heart attacks and strokes. Tragic story. These are kids with, if anything, capricious intelligence, and yet their bodies are wasting away. We found the gene for that 5 years ago. And because we found the gene, we figured out what it normally does, and we figured out what's wrong with it in the disease. And today, there are 30 kids with progeria, which is about all that we could find in the world because it's such a rare disease, that are on a clinical trial that started 6 months ago with a drug which, in an animal model, cures the disease and which we're hopeful might work also for these kids. If it does, the next question somebody's going to ask is, well, maybe you could give that to normal people and they could live longer. Or maybe you could at least rub it on their skin because there's a big market out there, in case you haven't heard. And that's not really the idea that we had in mind, but it's all kind of connected. And again, that sort of points out this difficulty in bright lines between enhancement and disease. That's true of obesity. It's true of aging. It's certainly going to be true of a lot of other conditions. I agree with you. I don't know that the idea of immortality is necessarily either realistic or laudable in terms of what we should be striving for ourselves. For me, as a believer, I have the sense that what my spirit is about is not just limited to what's going to happen here. And if I'm trapped here, maybe that's not such a good thing. Not everybody will agree with that. Yes? Well, don't both sit down. Yes. You're next. Make room for my belief in free will. How do I make room for free will in an age of materialism? mostly on common sense basis. I mean, again, I hope you got the sense from what I'm talking about that even when we understand all the nuances of DNA, we will not understand a lot about what it means to be human. That so much of who we are and what we are is not hardwired in that fashion. We have predispositions of various sorts driven by our heredity from our parents, but much of what we are things we've acquired through experience. So materialism, if applied to genetics, is no threat to free will any more than it's a threat to human personality in anything except a very small way. I guess the main argument with free will, and I'm sorry, I'm not a philosopher and I'm not going to do a better job of really nailing this one, is just plain human experience. Does your free will seem to you like an illusion? When I decided to ask you to ask that question and he stood up at the same time, were you driven by some invisible force? Or were you both using your free will to try to ask a question? What does it seem like? And if you think this is all materialism and it's all actually deterministic because the laws of physics, once the universe got started, were going to be completely predictive of everything that happened after that, then read Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and it will save you from that risk. Even if there are other things that ought to save you too, that one coming straight out of science will make that kind of deterministic future no longer tenable, at least in human terms. Yes, sir. Absolutely. So in our own species, humans, skin color is a great example. Most of the people in this room that I can see from where I am are mutants. You have a mutation in the SLC24A5 gene, a gene which normally confers dark pigmentation to the skin, and which most people of Northern European extraction, probably almost 100% of us, have in a mutated form, which is one of the reasons that we were able to survive in Northern Europe and not get rickets. So there's evolution in action in our own species at the molecular level. Certainly as a physician, you see evolution every day in medicine, particularly in infectious diseases. The reason why we have all these antibiotic-resistant organisms is because under natural selection pressure of seeing all those antibiotics that have been given willy-nilly over the decades, the occasional organism that's resistant has been able to grow, and that's why we have MRSA and other antibiotic-resistant tuberculous strains and so on that are giving us quite a fit. That is absolutely the consequence of a natural selective process operating on a population of organisms so that a rare mutant that confers resistance is able to outgrow its neighbors and present us with the next challenge. It is not hard to give other examples of that sort. Milk digestion. Most of you who came from Northern Europe, you're okay having an ice cream cone tonight if you decide you want to. It's a nice evening. Go ahead. People who came from West Africa would have trouble, many of them, doing so because they have a different genetic variant that shuts down the ability to digest milk at about age 2 or 3 at the usual time of weaning. So Northern Europeans, because of agriculture, which began to incorporate milk into the diet, there was a selection process for those that could handle that better, and they were a bit healthier, and they were able to have a few more kids, and over the course of time, that becomes an almost universal benefit. Go and look at the Maasai tribe in East Africa. Interesting example, because they also have milk in their diet, and they do fine. Look at their lactase gene. What do you know? They have a different mutation than the Europeans do, but it has the same effect. Again, must have been in there somewhere in the population, got selected for a little bit as milk began to be introduced into the diet, and now it's universal in the Maasai. Lots of it. Oh, now here we go. Okay, good question. So this could be a long answer, but I will try not to make it so. If you really want the answer, read the book, The Language of God, because a great significant part of the middle of it is devoted to just that question, because I think this is such a vexing problem for many believers. If those scientists are telling us that evolution is true, how can we be confident anymore in our faith? So what's the area of tension here? I think the area of tension is evolution tells you about descent from a common ancestor over long periods of time by the process of natural selection, and the data supporting that is overwhelming. And it's overwhelming not just for other species, but it is overwhelming for ourselves. And I can give you specific examples that cannot really be rectified with similarities that God might have used in using the same motifs with different species, but in fact point convincingly that this had to be descent from a common ancestor. But I'm a believer. Does my head explode when I say that? Am I in trouble here? No. I mean, the reason that I think we've gotten ourselves into this big controversial mess is a very specific and limited interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, which said that the descriptions there of the 6 days of creation and of Adam and Eve were intended to be literal descriptions of events that happen in exactly that order and over that period of time. If you go back before Darwin, you will not find a lot of leading theologians reading the same Bible who felt that that was the only acceptable interpretation. Augustine, in 400 AD, writes this beautiful description of what Genesis is supposed to mean. In fact, he writes 5 books about this and ultimately concludes there is no real way to know what is being described in Genesis and whether this is partly myth or partly history or some mix of the two. If Augustine in 400 AD, reading the same Bible, could not figure out what that answer was, why are we today faced with scientific evidence that is overwhelming about the age of the earth and about descent from a common ancestor, insisting that if you have to be a really sincere believer, the only acceptable interpretation is a young earth and evolution has to be wrong? If you believe in God, and God is the creator of all this, there's no real problem. If God chose to use the mechanism of evolution to carry out this amazing creation of everything we see around us, all this marvelous diversity of living things, what a cool idea. What an amazing mechanism to put together a planet full of diversity, of body plans, and ultimately to give rise to creatures with sufficient brains to be able to have intelligence and to be able to have free will and to be given the gift of the moral law and the opportunity to search for God in a way that other creatures have not figured out how to do. Would that not be an amazing mechanism to achieve the goal that we read about in Genesis? I think it would. In fact, I find this a powerful way to put this all together. Now, some would call that theistic evolution. That's sort of an unfortunate term, sort of puts people off. Evolution's the noun. What the heck does theistic mean anyway? What we're really talking about is God speaking life into being, using the principles of physics and chemistry, which, after all, God designed in the first place at the beginning of the universe. And why should we object to that? I call this bios, life through logos, through the word, or biologos. For me as a believer, and for most other scientists I know who are believers, this is a totally comforting, meaningful, complementary synthesis of the worldviews that makes it possible to be a rigorous scientist who examines nature looking for answers and also somebody who looks at God in great awe and can be a follower of Jesus Christ and who believes that God gave us that gift of both the soul, the free will, the moral law, and his son, Jesus Christ. I learned that in my 20s. I didn't grow up that way. It's remarkable how many other scientists have arrived at that conclusion thinking that they were the only ones. And it's remarkable how many people have not heard that it's possible to put these things together. We are in the midst right now of an uncomfortable battle between the extreme voices of fundamentalist atheism on the one hand and fundamentalist conservative Christianity on the other. And it is leading us in a direction that I don't think we want to go, where one has to win and the other has to lose. These are both ways of exploring God. I can find God in the genome just as much as I can find God in the Bible. I can find God in the laboratory or here in a church. God is the author of all this. He could hardly be threatened by our puny minds beginning to discover how it all works. That was more of a speech than you wanted, but thank you for the question. And it looks as if it's time to close this down. One last question back here. Yes, sir.
Ha ha ha.
It's appropriate. I've been characterizing the stronger end of atheism, and there are weaker forms. In fact, it usually is called strong atheism, which says, I know there is no God. And weak atheism, which says, I see no evidence for there being a God, I see no reason to believe in God, but I'm not quite going there to say, I know there is no God. And of course, weak atheism blurs over into agnosticism, and it's a little hard to say where that line is as well. I would simply say that when it comes to strong atheism or fundamentalist atheism, there's a serious logical flaw here. There's a category error in that one is generally, when you hear those pronouncements, hearing a statement that our ability to understand the natural world excludes God, that we're now so smart in our ability to understand nature through physics and chemistry and biology and all the rest, that there's no more need to postulate God. Is it not immediately clear that science is the wrong way to answer the question, is there a God? Science is about nature. If God has any meaning, unless you're a pantheist, then God has to be at least in part outside of nature, and therefore science has to remain silent about God's existence. And Stephen Jay Gould made that point quite brilliantly on numerous occasions. One way to put this is, if you were asked to draw a circle that represents all of the knowledge that has ever been known or ever will be known, all of it, draw that circle. Most of us would go, well, that's a huge circle of knowledge. Now, draw what you know right now on the same scale. Even Richard Dawkins would have to make a little circle at that point. Suppose then that the knowledge of God's existence is outside your little circle this evening. How could you then, on a purely rational ground, say, I know there is no God? Is that not stepping outside of the evidence? Are you not doing what is something you're supposed to avoid, which is to assert a universal negative without being able to look at the universe of information? I think that's a pretty strong argument against strong atheism. Weak atheism, agnosticism, you can defend those, although I would say to the agnostics in the audience, because I once was, agnosticism is a principled position if you've considered all the evidence for and against. If it's just a way of avoiding the topic, maybe it's not as principled. And this is, after all, the most important question that we ever ask ourselves, is there a God? If you haven't really investigated that, it's pretty much fun to do so, but don't be surprised where you end up. I was pretty surprised. End of speech. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.